Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the African Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Thomas Uber. I'm thrilled to introduce today Dr. Anne Hugon, Associate Professor of African History at Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne and a member of the Institut des Mondes Africains. We'll be discussing her book, Être mère en situation coloniale, Gold Coast, années 1910 à 1950, published in 2020 with the Édition de la Sorbonne. Dr. Hugon, thank you for being here and welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here with you for this conversation.
Thank you. So to begin with, please tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to the study of African history.
Well, thank you for this question. I guess what brought me to the study of African history is, I would say, a mixture of serendipity and an interest for African cultures, if this very general term means anything. I was a teenager in the 1980s and I spent a year in London at that time. And it was a time when the struggle against apartheid in South Africa was quite strong. And this brought an interest in political activities. I went to a lot of concerts and there was a strong, you know, mobilization. I was then in secondary school, but I used to listen to a lot of African music, but it was not just music per se. It was also the world of music in, you know, political struggles, which interested me. And as a student, a few years later, but only 2 or 3 years later, I became interested in the ways European had invented Africa and how they had created a form of radical otherness, which was embodied by the African. But at the same time, how this image was sort of distilled in various versions with the use of ethnography, which was then a new science at the end of the 19th century. And of course, this coincided with the beginnings of colonization, etc. So at this point, when I was studying history and also anthropology together, Mary Kingsley, the Victorian British female explorer, was crucial for me because her book had just been republished about 1990, years later, after its first publication. It was around 1980, I guess, that it was republished in facsimile. And I discovered this book through one of my teachers at university. And I just loved her book. I loved the way in which she wrote and the difference she made in the, with the predominantly male travel literature which was not only masculine, but really strongly virile. And I was intrigued by what she said about missionaries in West Africa. This is how I started working on the Gold Coast, where Wesleyan missionaries had started working in the 1840s. So I started a PhD on the history of Methodism on the Gold Coast in the 19th century, trying to understand why people on the Gold Coast were attracted to this form of Christianity and how they had adopted it, but of course also transformed it thereby. So this is what brought me to the study of African history. And what's interesting is how I started being interested in the ways in which Europeans saw Africa and slowly got derived, so to speak, and got more interested in the history of African societies themselves.
Wonderful, thank you. So maybe let's turn now to the book. And you've given us this very compelling, as you say, social history of the Gold Coast through the prism or the lens of maternité, and the term itself in French seems to encapsulate a range of different meanings, from the biomedicalization of reproduction to motherhood and mothering. And tell us maybe a little bit about the genesis of this project and the questions you were trying to answer through this study.
Okay, so what happened is that I defended my PhD in 1995, and it took me another 4 years before I was able to go to Ghana again, by which time I had become more interested in women's history, which was at the time, especially in France, still a relatively new field in history. So I went to the archives, and I think the question I was trying to address very broadly was that of the impact of colonialism on women's lives versus men's lives, I mean, African women versus African men. And my hypothesis, which of course is not counterintuitive at all, was that African men and African women were not impacted in the same ways by colonialism. They literally didn't see the same aspects of colonization. So this was my hypothesis. So I just went to the archives, and this was really what you would call an empirical method. I just started ordering documents with anything, I mean, any kind of document with women in the title. So I ended up with files on women in prisons or on widows asking to be given half the pension of their deceased husbands and so on and so forth. And it took me a few weeks, not much, I would say maybe a week or two, to realize that there was actually a whole series of documents on the Accra Maternity Hospital, the training of midwives, the running of maternity and child welfare centers, and also on British women medical officers, for example, and that all this taken together constituted the basis for a study on the medicalization of pregnancy and childbirth, and also on new ethics of motherhood, so to speak. So so yes, that's how I started, and these are the very broad questions that I had in mind when I started on this project, working on this project. So now the specificity of the Gold Coast case is, I would say, the emphasis which was put by colonial medical doctors and also by African medical doctors, which was put on infant and maternal mortality as the main causes of depopulation, which was a big anxiety at the time. So I would say that in the Congo, it was the duration of breastfeeding, which was considered to impair population growth, in Uganda. It was syphilis, which was blamed for the same problem. But in the Gold Coast, it was the appalling mortality rates, which were seen as the key element in population stagnation.
Wonderful, thanks. Thank you. And I mean, you've mentioned this already a little bit in terms of talking about the material and the methods that you're using. But in addition to this broad analysis of different archives from Accra and the UK, in the UK as well, and you also use oral histories with retired midwives. And I was wondering how you balance these sources and also how you thought of analyzing the colonial archives that still tended to be predominantly produced by colonial, male colonial administrators, for example.
Yes, well, again, it took me only a few days to realize that considering the period that I was working on, which was the interwar period, the training of midwives had started in the late 20s, for example. There were probably still retired midwives around, and I could have access to them. And it just so happened that in the archives at the time, there was someone who was going to become a colleague in the US, who's Abana Osirasari. And we started talking, and she said to me, "Oh, you know, I know a midwife, and maybe you could, a retired midwife, you could visit her and ask her if she'd give you an interview." So she gave me her phone number, I called her. And this was the beginning. This was 1999, and I had my first interview with a retired midwife at the time. After that, I had about 30 interviews with colonial midwives, quote unquote. By that, I mean midwives who were trained during the colonial period. Some of them were very old, in their 90s. Some of them were actually not retired, even though they were in their 80s. I remember two of them who were still working and visited their clinic. And this was these were absolutely wonderful moments, I have to say. It made my research so different from what I had experienced for my PhD, for example. The fact that I could have interviews, sometimes several, go back to these women year after year, this was really amazing. And I still have the recordings of those interviews. So then I typed everything, which of course is time consuming, as everybody knows. But still, it was really worth it. Of course, one of the things that I liked about these interviews is that they filled gaps, you know, which were in the archives, notably on these midwives' social origins, for example, but also their lived experience of pupil midwives and then licensed midwives, etc. So as to the fact that most of my written sources are androcentric in their production, yes, this is absolutely true. But I think this is a question that should be answered in multiple ways. Of course, these sources are mostly produced by men. And I mean the sources which I found in Accra, but also in all the other archive centers that I visited in Ghana. I went to all of them. And also the ones in Britain, of course. They are mostly produced by men, members of the colonial administration or members of the medical services. And these sources represent the biggest part of the material that I relied on. And of course, they convey a strong sense of both European and masculine superiority. And I regretted, you know, I was sorry I could not find enough written sources stemming from ordinary women, those who were constantly talked about in the sources, but who rarely spoke themselves and of themselves. However, there are two things that I'd like to say about this lack. One of them is that women were in the archives. Of course, they were spoken about, as I said. But, you know, there's this cliche, which is that African women don't appear in the sources. This is not true, especially if you focus on matters of reproduction. The other thing is that had I had sources stemming from these women, of course I would have been very happy and I would probably have ended up with a different kind of book. However, I think it's important not to romanticize the kind of sources which come from the people themselves. And it's important that historians should keep a distance between themselves and the sources wherever they come from. And I think, or at least I was trying to have a critical distance with my archives and all the time being aware of their, you know, racial bias, their gender bias, their sense of superiority, the racism, of course, which is so clear in so many of these sources. But at the same time, I think it's very important to remember that if I'd had sources from ordinary African women, I would still have needed to be critical and not just take them for granted.
Of course. Thank you so much. And thanks for this reflection on just analyzing a corpus of archives or even just any sources that we're relying on. So maybe let's jump into some of the empirics of the book. And I think in the beginning of your study, you start out with this 1917 report that kind of that has an influence on the entire arc, it seems, of a lot of the book and of the different questions you're analyzing, which is this report on infant mortality that it seems to encapsulate both some of the colonial demographic concerns around depopulation, the issues of biomedicalization of birthing, through notably a stigmatization of traditional birth attendants, and also finally a focus on blaming mothers for infant mortality as opposed to structural and economic reasons. Tell us a little bit about this report and notably the role of one key doctor, Dr. Nanka Bruce, in making infant mortality this central policy issue in the Gold Coast.
Okay, yes. Well, in Accra, I had found quite a lot of documents which referred to a report on infant mortality or the 1917 report on infant mortality, but I had actually never found the report itself. And I found it thanks to my colleague and friend John Parker from SOAS. One day he wrote to me and said, oh, at the National Archives in London, in Kew, I found this file. I think it may be of interest for you. So he gave me the shelf mark. And then next time I was in London, I ordered it. And I ended up with a thick file of over 100 pages, which has a lot of appendices and so on. And it took me a while to understand the architecture of this report. Mm-hmm. So the origin of the report was a letter written by a Dr. Nanka Bruce, who was of Ga origin. He was born in Accra, and he had been trained in Edinburgh at the end of the 19th century. So after he graduated, he came back to the Gold Coast and tried to be hired as a medical doctor in the colonial service as a civil servant. And for odd reasons, he was unable to get a position because he had failed to let the administration know that he was leaving for Britain years before. So there was something in his, in his file, which prevented him from being employed by the government. So he started a private medical practice, and he was a very popular medical doctor. So he was quite wealthy. But he was also a member of this very peculiar African, urban, Christian, Anglophone, Anglophile elite, which is a very intriguing and interesting category at the time, because they have a lot in common with the English government or British government in terms of, you know, cultural references and worldview and so on. But there's a huge difference in the way they see the role of this particular group, the African elite, in the running of a colony.
Right.
They are people who want to be employed in high positions, and because they have the diplomas, the training for this kind of position, they challenge the racism which prevents them from getting these positions. And Nanka Bruce is typically this kind of person. So he founded a newspaper, which is a weekly, the Gold Coast Independent. And in his newspaper, he keeps criticizing the way in which the colonial government runs the colony. What's interesting, though, is that he doesn't criticize colonization as such, because at the time, people like him see colonialism as a way, or possibly the way, of modernizing Africa. But when he wrote to the governor in 1915, it was again, or maybe that early, it was already with a sense of responsibility that the government somehow was not keeping their promises, you know. What he says is, as a government, you are responsible for the welfare of the people. And we, as a people, are losing a lot of children and of women in childbirth. So you must do something. And of course, it has to be borne in mind that this was the First World War. And in 1915, when he wrote this letter to the governor asking him to do something about infant and maternal mortality, he went as far as to say the Germans in Togo, in neighboring Togo, are doing much better than the British in the Balkans, which of course was probably not to the governor's taste. Anyway, so this is how he started, making infant mortality a colonial policy issue. It took the governor another 2 years before he actually did something about this letter. And he set up an ad hoc committee on infant mortality, whose mission was to try to understand what the causes of infant mortality in Accra were. And this committee was composed mostly of men, mostly of medical men, but not only. There was a sanitary officer and a missionary and a few other people. And then there was one woman who happened to be Nanka Bruce's own sister. And they started their inquiry, trying to understand what was going on. They even interviewed two quote-unquote traditional midwives, trying to see whether their methods were, you know, responsible for maternal mortality and so on and so forth. And the conclusions of this report was it was mostly the women's responsibility if infants and women were dying shortly after childbirth. So the idea was that midwives had to be trained, and also that mothers had to be trained to raise their children properly.
Great. Excellent. Thank you. And so I think the other aspect that you developed quite interestingly throughout the book is also questions of how different medical centers, notably the Accra Maternity and some of the infant and maternal welfare centers, were then repurposed by the people who used them, African women who went to these centers. And contrary to some of the colonial administrators' views that women might not use these centers, actually they became quite very popular during the interwar period and well into the 50s. So maybe tell us about how this came about and how these institutions were then repurposed by their users.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's important to understand that the colonial way of saying things was that African women were backwards, and B, they would only start using these medical centers if they gave up all other kinds of therapeutics. This was the very binary way of seeing the world in colonial times. You were either, into biomedicalization, or you were into traditional medicine, but in their eyes, you couldn't use both. And of course, their own purpose was to get rid of anything which was not biomedical and replace the old by the new, so to speak. What they had not seen in advance was that African women were not what they called backwards, and B, that they didn't mind using all kinds of methods in order to secure healthy, progeny, children. So because of these two reasons, the colonial medical officers were very surprised to see how popular the Accra Maternity Hospital, but also the Princess Mary Louise Children's Hospital, and all the infant and maternal welfare centers, which were preventive medicine centers, how popular all these institutions became. The sources show how, there were huge queues outside these centers. One medical doctor says that she had to see 200 children in one day. You can imagine how not thorough these medical consultations were. However, this is a good testimony of the popularity of these centers. So that's the popularity. However, the women used the centers not exactly in the way they had been organized by the colonial administration, especially the infant and maternal welfare centers, because these centers were supposed to run along preventive lines, as they said at the time, which meant that mothers were supposed to bring healthy children so that the doctor or the nurses could check that the child was healthy. And this, of course, didn't make much sense to most African women. They could see that their child was healthy and therefore did not really need to spare the time and cost of transport, because these centers were free. But the cost of transport was important. So they really didn't see the point of bringing a healthy child to hear a doctor say that the child was healthy. It has to be remembered also that this was in a context where institutions were scarce. Therefore, because there was a dramatic lack of medical staff, they transformed these preventive centers into curative medical centers by bringing sick children to the centers. So that the women doctors, the British women doctors who'd been hired to practice preventive medicine in these centers, ended up practicing curative medicine with sick children. And they were actually quite happy with this turn themselves. The ones who were not too happy about it were the administrators, especially the director of medical services, who literally thought that the centers had been, so to speak, hijacked by both African women, mothers, and European medical doctors, the lady medical officers or women medical officers, as they were called at the time. And this, I think, says a lot about the agency of African women, but also of British medical officers. In the end, the director of medical services even sort of closing down these centers for good in order to literally punish the women, you know, for their agency. But petitions were signed in most of the towns where the centers were threatened, and they were sent to the governor. And in the end, these centers were not closed down. They were transferred to the Red Cross or kept in the hands of the government, or sometimes transferred to missionary bodies, as in Kumasi, for example.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you. And I think this leads us maybe to our next question, which I think, as you emphasize initially, the this question of maternal and child and infant health in the Gold Coast seemed to have been envisioned, at least by colonial administrators and some predominantly male doctors, as a government project, that you argue there was a progressive shift from this being a uniquely government prerogative to something that was more of a mixed model that relied on different institutions. And one of these institutions that you talk about is notably the Gold Coast League for Maternal and Child Welfare. Maybe tell us a little bit about that project and that institution, and the equilibrium between government and some of these non-governmental projects.
Yeah. It's true that another specificity of the Gold Coast, taken as a part of the British Empire, is that the welfare of women and children was seen in the Gold Coast as a prerogative of the government, whereas in other colonies, all other colonies, as far as I can tell, it was transferred by the government to missionaries mostly. So this was, at the beginning, seen as a state system, so to speak, which is why these centres were free, why the Accra Maternity Hospital was also free for women who gave birth there and so on. But after the Great Depression hit the Gold Coast in the early 30s, and also because at the same time, like I said, these both African women and British female doctors had hijacked the preventive centres. There was a shift, and the turning point is 1932. And like I said, it became a mixed system. At the same time, the Red Cross, in fact, when the Red Cross started intervening, it had itself stemmed from another voluntary body or association called the Gold Coast League for Maternal and Child Welfare. And this was a really peculiar association because, as far as I can tell, it was not a female-only association in that it was run mostly by men, but the members themselves were all women, and it was a combination of African and European women who together, two of them, a woman from Europe and a woman from Africa, were supposed to go from door to door in Accra to tell pregnant women or women who had just given birth where to go for postnatal consultations or visits, to go to weighing clinics, or where to go for prenatal consultations. So this was a voluntary body whose mission was to, so to speak, evangelize the Accra population into new methods of childbirth and new ways of dealing with a pregnancy and new ways of handling a newborn baby. So this is interesting because it tells us that although the project of the government was to run most of the maternal and child welfare work in the colony, it also relied on voluntary work. These women were active in organizing baby shows, for example, or jumble sales. In these gatherings, they made sure that the right propaganda was delivered to the mothers. Sometimes it was even difficult for some of the staff, people who had been trained to be midwives, for example, found it difficult to see their work recognized because there was a sort of, how should I put this? The difference between somebody who was a professional and somebody who was just a volunteer was somehow blurred sometimes. So it was what I call the reform of motherhood and of maternity was relied on both government work and voluntary work.
And I think one of the very compelling aspects of the book is also this analysis of these tension between professionalization of the biomedicalization of giving birth, and as you said, this volunteering. One of the social groups that you're analyzing is notably these European women doctors who are in part being forced by the administration to do mostly preventive work initially. And you also focus on the training of African midwives throughout this period. So maybe tell us a little bit about these two different groups.
The first group was the group of LMOs, lady medical officers, was mostly important in the second half of the 20s. After that, because of the Great Depression, most of them were made redundant, and therefore their numbers declined. So in the late 1920s, there were nearly 10 of them, which is an important figure, considering the number of medical doctors in the colony in general. And they, interestingly, all of them were recruited specifically for maternal and child preventive work, but most of them didn't particularly like it. And so much, or so little so, that in the early 30s, they wrote a petition saying that they would rather be involved in curative medical work like their male counterparts or colleagues. Of course, one of the reasons for this petition was that because preventive work was less noble, they were also less paid than their male colleagues. And it took the administration a few years to, in the end, give them an equal salary. But at the time, there were only a handful of them left. Most of them had been sent back to either Britain or other colonies. Now, African midwives were an absolutely crucial element of this reform and biomedicalization of pregnancy and childbirth. They started being trained at the Accra Maternity Hospital, which was also a school, a midwife school, in the late 20s. The first batch of midwives got their qualification in 1931. It was a very difficult level of studies. They were trained for 3 years as pure midwives, as they said. And interestingly, the model was more a French model than a British model. In Britain at the time, there were only nurse midwives, meaning that women were trained as nurses and a little midwifery. Whereas in the Gold Coast, they were trained as pure midwives. So for 3 years, they studied only anything that had to do with pregnancy and childbirth. After 1936, they were housed in a hostel, the midwives hostel, on, I would say, the campus. It was not a campus. It was actually the hospital premises, the Corlibu hospital premises. The idea was that they had to be under the supervision of their teachers, and this would guarantee their, you know, moral behavior. So, of course, everybody at the time was quite worried that young women would be sent to a capital city, even though Accra was still a fairly small town at the time. And in order to encourage families to send their daughters to Accra for in order to study midwifery, this midwives hostel was built. And because as of 1936, they lived for 3 years together, this created an esprit de corps, which was very important later on in the moral values and in the way these women saw themselves. I think it it's possible to speak of the identity of midwives, you know, in the 40s and 50s, and probably later on as well. So these midwives were the most qualified women in the whole country. And it has also to be said that it was the only elite profession which was female only. Mm-hmm. Teachers, for example, were both men and women, and actually women were a minority among teachers. And it was the same is true for any other field except midwifery, where the midwives were absolutely all female. And little by little, this created a new identity, both for themselves and in the way they were seen. One important element is the uniform, for example. Midwives in the Gold Coast were called the blue nurses, as opposed to the green nurses, who were the general nurses. So you could tell who was a midwife. And of course, the uniform is also linked to, you know, the official, the government, and so on and so forth. And it's an element of prestige. Most of these qualified midwives chose to settle a private practice because the government service at the time was not easy. You would be sent from one position to the other in the country, notwithstanding your marital status, the number of children you had to take on with you, and so on. So a lot of them chose to practice in their own private clinics. At the beginning, in the 1940s, they received a subsidy from the government because a lot of the women could not pay what they were supposed to pay for giving birth in private clinics. The other interesting thing about midwives is that it's unclear how they saw themselves in relation to the government. Mm-hmm. In many ways, they considered themselves as part of the colonial system, and they had also adopted part of the colonial worldview. But of course, on the other hand, they were quite sensitive to the fact that sometimes they were bullied by their teachers, and partly because, or maybe only because they were black pupils. So their relation to the government was very ambiguous. The other thing is that depending on where they started their clinic, they were more or less welcome. One of the things which, again, is not counterintuitive, but it's important to insist on that still, is that socioeconomic factors played a great role in the choices women made about where and with whom they would give birth. So a lot of educated women preferred either going to hospital or going to a private clinic, whereas a lot of illiterate women preferred giving birth at home, but possibly calling a qualified midwife to attend their childbirth. So the way they were seen. And another thing which struck me when I was going around Accra for these interviews was that it's always so easy to locate a midwife. Everybody knows a midwife in a neighborhood. So if I came and said, I would like to interview Mrs. So-and-so, she's a midwife, I know she lives in this neighborhood, but I'm not sure exactly where, in a few seconds, I would find somebody who would lead me to the house. And this also tells a lot about how they were seen and how important they were to the communities in which they worked.
And I was wondering, to your point about their midwives' ambivalence to sort of their links with government policies and whatnot, you mentioned notably a range of different perspectives as we approach independence and the different questions, the different political parties and different perspectives on what independence might look like. Did you, in your research, what did you learn notably about the position of these midwives in at this moment of independence?
Well, this is something I somehow did not enough address in the interviews. I was sorry I hadn't, but then it was too late. So I did a bit. But I did not think at the time that it was very important to ask them about their political, you know, views and how they got mobilized, especially in the late 40s. But some of them, however, mentioned their own involvement in politics. And several of the ones I interviewed had been given high official positions in the Ministry of Health after independence, which means this was under Nkrumah, that they had been faithful to the CPP and to the struggle for independence. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten these positions. I'm thinking notably of Dosi Akise, whose a picture was actually used on the banknote in Ghana in the 1990s, for example, or another one whose husband was an ambassador and who had also had an important position in the Ministry of Health. And both of them were among my interviewers. But I asked them more questions about their daily lives somehow. And what they did tell me was how Accra midwives had organized a lot of outings in the 50s, for example, and early 60s, how they used to gather once a month to talk about midwives things. That's how they put it. One of them had said, if you have all work and no fun, it's a dog's life. Mm-hmm. So they would gather together in order to have fun at least once a month. And my hypothesis is that this was a way of continuing what had been their lot while they were in the midwives' hostel, a way of, you know, being together and of remembering their youth and so on. So, yeah, this was very important.
Wonderful. Thank you. I think finally, in the last parts of the book, you kind of zoom out a little bit, and you notably mention that you're interested in thinking about the moral economy of maternité, and notably certain shifts in new priorities and maybe challenges around questions relating to childbirth and reproduction that happened throughout the colonial period. What do you mean by this question of analyzing a moral economy of maternité, and what are these new imperatives?
So what I meant by moral economy was actually the ideology or ideologies of maternité, and how there were actually several conflicting ideals of motherhood in the colonial period. And sometimes they were conflicting even among African communities, you know, depending on the socioeconomic status and also on the cultural origins of a woman, the idea that she has of what a good mother is, of course, may be different from that of her neighbor, for example. So this was what I was trying to do. So part of this chapter deals with the question of genital mutilations in northern Ghana, and how this practice, which has to do with the moral economy of motherhood, a good mother in some societies of northern Ghana at the time is a woman whose genital parts have been partly removed. And the colonial administration is very worried about these practices, undesirable practices, as Jessica Kamat wrote in her book. So the government is anxious to know whether this kind of mutilation has an impact on childbirth. If the answer is no, then it's clear that the government won't do anything about it, or very little. And unsurprisingly, this is the conclusion they write about, which is that genital mutilation is not a medical problem. And if it's just a moral problem, then they will not interfere with it. But interestingly, in the south of the country, where most midwives practice, and most midwives were from the southern part of the country, genital mutilation is also seen partly as a backwards practice, and very much like what the colonial administrators analyzed. The other thing is that the new imperatives, the new ideals of what a good mother is that it should be that's the colonial viewpoint. It's the biological mother who should look after her own children. So that's the basis. And of course, this conflicts with the circulation of children, the fact that a lot of families and households are not monogamous and are intergenerational, and that most women are working women. So there's a new ideal of what a good mother is, but it's extremely limited in the number of women who somehow abide to this new ideal. The other thing is that there's a new anxiety, or maybe it's not new, but it becomes very clearly a real anxiety, a very strong one in the colonial period. People want to have children, and not only do they want to have children, they want their children to grow up and reach adulthood, and thereby become themselves, you know, ancestors and become adults before even becoming ancestors. So therefore, child mortality, and also, of course, maternal mortality, is a huge problem in the way people themselves experience it, which is, in my opinion, one of the reasons why biomedicine was quite popular, which doesn't mean that people, you know, adopted it without fear. There was fear, but still it was popular. So this, in my opinion, shows that what I call the obsession about reproduction was such at the time that the biomedicalization promoted by colonial administration was welcome in many ways. And again, I'm not saying that people just adopted it per se, but they transformed it, they had recourse to it, they used it in their own ways. And the same thing is true about the new ideals of motherhood. When they could make sense of what was told them, they would sometimes start looking after the children in different ways or new ways. But if it didn't appeal to them or if it was contrary to their daily lives, then they would just give up. There's this really funny anecdote whereby a medical doctor writes to a very important chief telling him, one of your wives came to me yesterday and I told her she should breastfeed her baby every 3 hours. Then she said to me she had no watch and what is good for European women is not good for African women. And of course, this, you know, breastfeeding every 3 hours, which was a new thing in the 1930s and had been globally imported from New Zealand, from a pediatrician from New Zealand, made absolutely no sense for a vast majority of the women on this planet, notably the women of the Gold Coast.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for this really fascinating conversation around your book. To conclude, maybe tell us a little bit about the projects you're currently working on.
Thank you. Yes. Well, after the book was published, or actually before it was published, I started working on a new project on juvenile delinquency in the Gold Coast. So the period is more or less the same because the anxiety about this group or supposed group of youth committing crime and various offences starts being visible in the sources in the interwar period. And so I'm trying to understand both how juvenile delinquency was created as a new phenomenon, but this has already been studied somehow in other colonies, and I don't think that the Gold Coast has anything specific, really. So what I'm more interested in is to try to understand who these children were, where they came from, and even more importantly, what happened to them once they had been pointed out by the colonial authorities. So there were some institutions which were created to reform these young boys because they were in the Gold Coast, the vast majority of them are boys. So this, as you can imagine, takes me to quite another population. Having worked mostly on women for this book, then I'm working mostly on young men and even boys. And I'm also trying to see what happened to them after independence. And possibly, if I find enough sources, I've tried to address the shift from juvenile delinquents to street children. So, you know, the change of discourse and also if there were any changes in the way authorities dealt with these young people.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for your time. And it was really wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you very much for your questions.
And to conclude, this is was a conversation with Anne Hugon about her book, Être mère en situation coloniale, Gold Coast, années 1910 à 1950, that was published in 2020 by the Édition de la Sorbonne. Thank you very much.
Thank you.